We have completed 9 chapters out of Revelation. We're going into chapter 10. We are in the middle of the 6 trumpets. 6 have sounded, and the 7th remains. Throughout these trumpets, judgments have been falling upon those who have rejected God, those who are not God's servants, those who are not, who have not been sealed. We have talked about how these trumpets follow the plagues, or at least they have echoes to the plagues of Egypt, that they are signs, and that we've talked about how signs do not necessarily convince those who have chosen to reject God, but rather signs are for those who have already accepted God. They are confirmation. These trumpets sounding, this is an allusion to the morning sacrifice ritual at the temple. The trumpets are a call for God to remember and to respond to his people's cries and prayers. Now we go into chapters 10 and 11, and Dr. John Pauline, a scholar of writings of John, in one of his books writes the following: "For me, Revelation 10 and 11 have been as difficult to understand as any part of the entire book." So one thing that we should take away is that we're not going to try to figure everything out here. And it's not that critical, probably, that we do. It's about the overall direction, overall message, rather than, well, what does this precise thing mean? Because Revelation was not meant to be studied in that way, you know, where each detail has some sort of meaning. He also writes that, particularly with the book of Revelation, many teachers of prophecy like to fill in too many details on which the text does not directly comment. So with that, let's read the first... No, actually, it's all of chapter 10. 11 verses, chapter 10. "Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head, and his face was like the sun, and his legs like pillars of fire. He had a little scroll open in his hand, and he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and called out with a loud voice like a lion roaring. When he called out, the 7 thunders sounded. And when the 7 thunders had sounded, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up what the 7 thunders have said, and do not write it down. And the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, for there would be no more delay. But that in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the 7th angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. Then the voice that I had heard from heaven spoke to me again, saying, go, take the scroll that is open in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land. So I went to the angel and told him to give me the little scroll. And he said to me, take and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. And I took the little scroll from the hand of the angel and ate it. It was sweet as honey in my mouth, but when I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. And I was told, you must again prophesy about many peoples and nations and languages and kings." That's the first part. So, rather than the 7th seal, not 7th seal, the 7th trumpet being sounded immediately, there seems to be another scene that enters in right after the 6th trumpet is sounded.
this scene, there is another mighty heavenly being that comes down. There's a fairly lengthy description of what this being looks like. One of the key elements is this being holds a little scroll, an open little scroll in his hand. And when he comes down, he sets his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. So, you know, in the imagination, the mental picture that you get is got the earth, and you've got this humongous being that's kind of standing on it. And when he raises his right hand, it reaches into the heavens. Then John, who is witnessing this vision, is told to go to this being, take the scroll. As he does so, he's given instructions on what he is to do with it. To eat it. After he eats it, he's commanded to prophesy again. So some thoughts. Again, the succession of trumpets sounding seems to be interrupted. Just as it happened with the seals, there appears to be kind of an interlude between the 6th and the 7th. There was an interlude between the 6th and 7th seals, where the 144,000 and the great multitude were described. The same way there is this interlude that appears to happen between the 6th and the 7th trumpet sounding. Now, just as in the seals, an angel comes from heaven to interrupt the sequence. And this angel speaks. And just as happened in the seals, John is instructed to interact with the vision. Now, in most of the visions, John is simply recording what he is seeing. He's describing what he's seeing, but occasionally he's told to interact with the vision. And this is one of those instances. The imagery that is given in this passage echoes those things that we have already seen. For example, there's a rainbow that was mentioned surrounding kind of the throne of God in chapter 4, verse 3. The anthropomorphic description of this being, like the sun, like pillars of fire, etc., etc., echoes that which was used to describe Jesus in chapter 1, verses 12 through 16. This scroll, there's a mention of a scroll, and a scroll was already mentioned in chapter 5. The scroll that could not, you know, that was sealed, that only the Lamb could open. Mentions of sea and land we find in chapters 5, chapter 7. A loud voice that speaks, we find that in chapters 1, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. The mention of a thunder, chapters 4, 6, and 8. The image of a being walking on the earth or being, you know, standing on the earth, we find as part of the introduction to the seven letters in chapter 1, verses 12 and 13. Jesus was walking among the lamps. The mention of God's servants. So this is in relation to, verse 7 of chapter 10, where just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. So the mention of God's servants, we find at the very first verse of this letter, chapter 1, verse 1, as well as chapter 6 and chapter 7. And the command to prophesy and to write down that's given to John, we find at the very beginning of this letter, chapter 1, verses 11 and 19. So some questions that the reader the audience might have at this point is, so what's this interruption that's happening in sounding of the trumpets? Why is this angel described using some of the same attributes that were previously associated with Jesus? What is this little scroll? Is it the Lamb's scroll that was unsealed, or is it a different scroll? What is this about the seven thunders, and why is John prevented from writing down what was said? What does it mean for the angel to stand upon the sea and the land? What is the mystery of God? And finally, is there any significance to the act of eating on John's part? A couple of paragraphs here in regards to maybe some background information that could be useful. These are both from the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary. Jewish literature pictures a number of angels as being as high as the highest heavens, often shining like the sun. Both evil angels and good angels could be very tall. Sometimes they were crowned, in this case with a rainbow. In the third book of Enoch, even the crown is more than a 500-year journey high. John borrows the imagery of his day for a powerful angel over creation. Raising one's hand toward a god was used in solemn oath formulas in Greek culture as well as in the Old Testament and later Jewish literature. Here John alludes to Daniel chapter 12 verse 7 where an angel lifted his hands toward heaven and swore by the one who lives forever and there would be only 3.5 more years until the end. Here, this angel swears that the time has come and there is no further delay. So with those few things in mind, we'll now go into the details of this passage. So first of all, is this passage an interlude between the sixth and seventh trumpets? It could be considered a separate message between the sixth and seventh trumpets. This would be in line between the sixth and seventh seals. The description of the 144,000 and the great multitude was, although it was related to the sixth seal, it was really a separate message. And so this, what's happening here between the sixth and seventh trumpets could be a separate message. However, in chapter 11, verse 14, there reads, "The second woe has passed. Behold, the third woe is soon to come." The first woe was the fifth trumpet, the second woe was the sixth trumpet, and the third woe is the seventh trumpet. So, 11:14 seems to indicate that this interlude that's happening between the sixth and seventh trumpet is actually a part of the sounding of the sixth trumpet. So although it's not directly, doesn't seem to be directly related to the sixth trumpet, it is an extension of what is happening with the sixth. And in fact, during the seals, the interlude that did happen was an expansion of the sixth. The sixth seal described the reaction of those who were experiencing the judgment that was falling. They were calling upon the rocks and the mountains to fall upon them. Whereas the interlude describes the sealing of God's servants and those who would not be affected by these judgments. So, in the literary function, we could consider both these interludes to be doing sort of the same thing. They are explaining from a different perspective what's going on during that same period. Verses 1 through 3 and 5 to 6 of this chapter, chapter 10, describes this mighty angel. This mighty angel is again described in terms of attributes that were previously used to describe Jesus. So it could be another angel, but we think of angel as a heavenly being, not necessarily associated with or being identical with God. But however, an angel could simply mean a messenger. And in the Old Testament, sometimes angels were attributed as being divine. They're called they're theophanies. Some of the angels that came to visit human beings were, in traditions, in Christian tradition, we think that some of them were the pre-incarnate Jesus. And so it's not entirely out of line to think of an angel as representing Jesus. And some commentaries do support this angel, this another angel, as being Jesus that's coming down from heaven. However, why does this being swear an oath by God's name? If this was Jesus, shouldn't he be swearing by his own name? In fact, the way the oath is described, the oath is being sworn by the name of the Creator. And throughout the New Testament, Jesus is identified as the Creator, so it seems a little out of place that this angel would be swearing by the name of the Creator God, if this was Jesus. And we won't take the time to look at it, but there are some differences in the descriptive details in terms of how Jesus was described in earlier chapters as compared to how this mighty angel is described. And if we think of the parallel interlude of the seals, in that passage, the angel was simply another angel. And so, given that, I think this is a literary device that John uses to emphasize to his audience that this mighty angel is very, very important. And that we need to pay attention, that this, what's happening here is a critical scene. In verses 2 and 8 through 11, this passage speaks about a little scroll that is open. So, it's possible that this could be the scroll that was unsealed, the scroll that we encountered earlier. If the mighty angel is Jesus, then certainly there's very strong evidence to indicate that this little scroll is the other scroll. But we've kind of established that this mighty angel probably is not Jesus. Not only that, but why, after spending so much time that John used building suspense in regards to the scroll's opening, why would after John has spent so much time describing the seals being opened, why would the scroll's opening be done behind the scenes and all of a sudden the scroll is already opened and appears? And we've also established in prior examination of these passages that the scroll that the Lamb is given was probably the Book of Life. And so, why would John be told to eat the Book of Life? It doesn't make much sense. Language-wise, there's a difference between this little scroll and the scroll that was given to the Lamb. The little scroll is Bibliardidion, meaning booklet. Literally, a little book. Whereas the scroll that was given to the Lamb
is described as a biblion, a book, a full book.
Although it should be noted that in verse 8, where it reads, go take the scroll, that scroll uses biblion instead of the other one. So there are two places where little scroll or booklet is used in this chapter, and one place where book is used. So perhaps the difference in word usage is just coincidental. Maybe we shouldn't be making such a big deal out of it. What a stronger evidence to say that this little scroll is different from the scroll given to the Lamb is the strong allusion that this passage has to Ezekiel chapter 2, verses 8 through chapter 3, verse 4. Look it up. So this is part of Ezekiel's call. Ezekiel's call to his mission. Chapter 2, verse 8 begins, but you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Be not rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you. And when I looked, behold, a hand was stretched out to me, and behold, a scroll of a book was in it. And he spread it before me. And it had writing on the front and on the back, and there were written on it the words of lamentation and mourning and woe. And he said to me, son of man, eat whatever you find here. Eat this scroll and go, speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he gave me this scroll to eat. And he said to me, son of man, feed your belly with this scroll that I give you, and fill your stomach with it. Then I ate it, and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey. And he said to me, son of man, go to the house of Israel and speak with my words to them.
So he wanted the message to be taken easily, but given all the sadness and the strength that it had later. So that's like the sweetness going, like...
sweet going down.
Take this message, mm-hmm. because you're my messenger. I'm going to make it easier for you to swallow. And then when everybody else receives it, it's a bitter message.
Could be.
Basically, is it...
It's a message of judgment. Right. Ezekiel is being given a message of judgment. Which is never an easy thing to give.
Right.
So why is it sweet?
We'll get to it, I think. So given what we just read in Ezekiel, the function of this little scroll is distinct from the scroll that the Lamb was given. This little scroll appears to contain a message of judgment that its recipient, the reader, the eater of it, is supposed to give.
Maybe the judgment, maybe the readers... maybe the sweetness and the bitterness is that for the one that's prepared for the judgment, it's not something that is difficult to understand.
Maybe.
But it's also hard to deal with because you're going to feel for the people that might have the different reaction than that. Anyway.
I still have a hard time imagining that being sweet. I don't know.
Well, we'll see. Verses 3 and 4 describe, mention seven thunders. thunders are traditionally associated with the voice of God. Uh-huh. And so it seems to be a message that God is giving. The Dead Sea Scrolls contain a fragmentary astrological text that includes dire predictions based upon the interpretation of thunder. Thunder is associated with judgment at several points in Revelation. This is from the commentary reading the New Testament. So, thunder has something to do with a message from God, probably a message of judgment, which is in line with all that we've been seeing so far. But John is called to seal up. Seal up is reminiscent of instructions that were given to Daniel regarding the visions that he was given. And you know, seal up basically means that these things are to remain a mystery. Uh-huh. And there's really no good interpretation of these thunder messages other than to say that some things of God remain a mystery. And his servants must be okay with that. Because we don't know. There's nowhere that before or after to indicate what the seven thunders said. You know, John was told to not write them down. Verse 5 notes sea, land, and heaven. This encompasses all of creation. Sea is traditionally the realm of the dead. Land is the realm of the living. Heaven is the spiritual realm of God. So, the entirety of creation. The entirety of the known world is included. So this mighty angel has been essentially handed authority over all creation. He's been delegated authority over all of creation. That his words and his judgment is going to affect the entirety of what God had created.
So could some of these, because like the angels in all of these, the seals, they all seem to be these like extremely powerful entities holding back or delegating a certain force. Could these all just be basically like not necessarily beings of their own person, like a specific being or chairman or something like that? Could they just be God himself acting in a way that this being would be portraying? I mean, you know, like it's like kind of like the like Oz, you know what I mean, having this like depiction of a grand being doing something, but in reality it's just God's force that he has that is capable of doing this or something like that instead of it. Because they're also mighty. I mean, you look at them and they're just like,
It is possible that these are certainly literal angels, but you know, it's far more likely that these are metaphors, that they're figures of speech. And as we've discussed previously, it was part of the ancient Greek, Roman, Jewish worldview that the powers of nature, different powers, were assigned to various angelic or demonic beings.
Yeah, singular entities that supposedly worked on their own.
Or for the Greek and Romans, there were different deities that were assigned different aspects of the world.
Right.
Who held power.
Right.
And so John is using that, the metaphor that is accessible.
Because when a lot of the times these angels are paying a tribute or defining their loyalty. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, that's like an action that God is making And at that action is defining the loyalty that the subject has to him himself. So it'd be like God saying that instead of God standing there in front of John, there's a different vision, so that he's not, you know, you're not actually seeing God, but you're seeing God's actions, and then a tribute to him saying that this is kind of by me, for me, of me, you know, like, type thing. I don't know, it just came kind of think that that's why I don't necessarily think that they want you to pick it apart, because it doesn't seem like.
So this mighty angel then swears an oath by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, that there would be no more delay, but that in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the seventh angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. It's verses 6 and 7. And it was mentioned already that this is an allusion, at least partly, to Daniel chapter 12, verse 7, which reads, "And I heard the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, and that it would be for a time, times, and half a time, and that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things would be finished." The language is very similar there between Daniel and Revelation. The key difference, what Daniel records, is that the events following the prophecy given to him would come after a time, times, and half a time, which translates to 3.5 years, or 1,260 days. And at this point, it's not important to try to figure out what those days mean, because that's not the point of Revelation. The point of Revelation, what John wrote, is that there will be no more delay. Whatever that time period that Daniel was looking at represents, it's done. There will be no more delay. This is the only occurrence of swearing of an oath that's found in Revelation. So this message then is of some particular importance. This word delay is chronos, and it was seen earlier in chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, in describing the fifth seal, where the saints were asking God when vindication would come, and they were told to rest a little longer. This little longer is also the same word, chronos. Delay and little longer. This chronos, then, what John is writing is, it's finished. The little delay, told to rest a little longer, that is done. The inference that we can draw from that is then that the time of judgment and vindication has come. Now we get to, what is this mystery of God? The word mystery in New Testament, when it's used, it almost always refers to the plan of God for the world. What Paul frequently wrote was, it was hidden. This plan of God for the world was hidden in the past. It was a mystery. But this mystery has now been revealed in and through Jesus. You can see that in Romans chapter 16, Ephesians 3, Colossians chapter 1. This mystery of God, it would be fulfilled. The time has come for it to be fulfilled. So God's plan for the world is about to be completed. And this fulfillment, as well as the plan, will be announced to his servants. This is an allusion to Amos chapter 3, verse 7, where he says God doesn't do anything but without first revealing it to his servants, the prophets. We see that language echoed in verse 7 of chapter 10 here. Just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. Then verses 8 through 11, John is told to, you must prophesy again, or you must again prophesy. This is the second commissioning of John. The manner is similar to that of Ezekiel, where he's given the scroll and told to eat it. It's sweet because, first of all, it is a message from God. A message from God to his servants is always sweet. And maybe it is also sweet because this prayer to God from the saints that, how long until, how long must we wait until judgment, until vindication is going to be fulfilled? It's bitter because it is a message of judgment, and as pretty much all messages of judgment, it's going to be rejected.
Well, then if the judgment had been accepted, and if people had accepted it, changed, done what God was asking them to do, then maybe it could have stayed sweet. That could explain sweet as well.
Whenever, almost invariably, when Old Testament prophets are commissioned to give message of judgment, they're also told that people aren't going to hear it. Same thing with John, basically. Give the message of judgment. It's something that has to be done, but people aren't going to hear it.
Except John, and he had a temper tantrum.
Why is John told to eat? Now, what does eating represent?
Accepting it,
but it's also internalizing, I think, of the message.
Uh-huh.
John not only gives a message, but perhaps he's told to identify with it, identify with Jesus, the giver of the message. And so John is going to experience a portion of the bitterness that Jesus experiences when his message is rejected.
Uh-huh.
It's one thing to just be given the message and to give the message as commanded. A person doesn't need to have any sort of emotional investment in the message that he or she is giving. But if there's no heart in it, then there's something missing, something lacking. When you eat something, it becomes a part of you.
Mm-hmm.
You're invested in that. And so a rejection of, you are the message now. And so when you're giving this message,
a rejection of the message becomes a rejection of you.
Right. In a sense.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it was sweet because it was God in you, and God's word and his message. And if it's accepted, good things will happen. And then it's rejected. You're rejected because you're invested in it now.
And you experience that, that suffering, that feeling of that same rejection that God or Jesus experiences when he's rejected.
You experience the rejection and you see the result of it. That people could have avoided. And it's bitter. That makes sense.
Those are the 11 verses. the entirety of chapter 10, the interlude between trumpets 6 and 7 sounding continues in the next chapter, chapter 11, the first part of it. But for now, we will stop there. This is one of those things where it's hard to come to some kind of what does it mean for me kind of thing, because it's kind of a description. It's just descriptive. It's not, there's not a whole lot of imperative, you know, or action that is being asked of its audience. So here are some summary points. First, the time on earth of history will eventually come to an end. That's what this is saying. God's plan for restoring creation to its original state, the shalom that God intends, will be fulfilled. There's no question there. This plan for restoration, some parts will remain a mystery to his servants until afterwards. Uh-huh. And we need to be okay with that. The gospel, the message from God, is a two-edged sword. It's sweet to those who accept. It's bitter for those who reject. And as we've kind of discussed, it's also bitter to those who have to give it. In spite of all that, we as God's servants are commissioned to deliver this gospel message. The message of the gospel is always a judgment. It requires a decision from its hearers.